So here's the basic question that I want to consider today. How might affective disturbances, or I'm using affect in a very broad sense to encompass emotions, moods, other feeling states, how might affective disturbances in psychiatric disorders be shaped by the individual's relationship with their material environment? So the last question talked about the material environment and distinction between, I think, the spiritual and the material. Alas, I don't feel qualified to make speculations about the spiritual realm. I wish I did. I'm going to focus on the material realm. And I'm doing this because I think this is not a relationship that's often given sufficient attention in phenomenological psychopathology. So I'm going to focus primarily on schizophrenia and depression, and I'm going to help myself to some concepts in phenomenology and more recent situated approaches to cognition. So there are three core concepts I'm going to talk about today: affordances, cognitive scaffolding, and then incorporation. And hopefully, I'm trying to avoid excessive jargon. I was instructed by Rachel not to get too jargony. I tend to be allergic to jargon, but we are academic philosophers after all, and I think it's just a tendency to lapse into jargon. But I'll do my best to avoid excessive jargon. So here's the main claim that I want to defend today. What I want to suggest is that a significant portion, part of the regulatory mechanisms that are ultimately responsible for affective disorders in schizophrenia and depression, lie beyond the individual's head. So they're a disturbance of the scaffold itself. It's not a matter of things happening just inside the individual. And why is this interesting? Well, I think there are two reasons this is potentially philosophically interesting. First off, this view, I think, puts some useful critical pressure on internalist or individualistic approaches to affective disorders. Secondly, I think it suggests, makes the practical significance of this, potentially suggests the need to rethink new avenues for treatment and intervention, how we go about intervening and helping people deal with these affective disorders. So unfortunately, I'm not going to say much about this last bit. I simply don't have the expertise here. So three parts to the talk today: a bit of conceptual background, part two, affective disturbances, and then final thoughts. I don't have many. One slide. That will be brief. Okay. Start with a bit of conceptual background. So affordances. Here's the first bit of jargon. Affordances. This is a term that some of you are probably familiar with. The notion of an affordance was first developed by the ecological psychologist, American psychologist James Gibson, although this notion is implicit in the work of Husserl, Merleau-Ponty, other phenomenologists. And simply put, an affordance is an action possibility in the perceiver's environment. So an affordances are specified or show up for us perceptually in virtue of both structures of the things that we perceive, whether they be tables, rocks, chairs, and trees, and also in virtue of the kind of bodies that we have. So affordances are supposed to be relational. They're not just objective features of things in the environment, nor are they just features of our body or first-person experience. In a sense, they're constituted by both. And so this notion for Gibson and other phenomenologists is supposed to highlight the reciprocity, the very intimate relationship between embodied perceivers and the kind of world they perceive. So maybe that's still a little bit too abstract, so let's make this concrete. So imagine I walk into my office. Now, alas, I do not look this dapper, like Bertrand Russell sitting in my office. It's not nearly this dignified, elegant. But I walk into my office. That environment immediately affords a range of different action possibilities. I can sit down at my desk, start typing on my computer. I can go to the shelf, reach for a book, and start reading it. I can take a nap on the floor. I can gaze out the window. I can go get some water, drink some coffee sitting on my desk. These things show up for me as action possibilities because I have a kind of body that can do these things. If my infant niece comes into my office, she won't perceive these same affordances in virtue of her developmental constraints. Here's another video that I like to show students to really demonstrate this notion of an affordance. So this is free running. These individuals are discovering and actualizing a whole range of environmental affordances that probably aren't available to the rest of us. So they're doing some pretty amazing things here. That's my favorite part. I like that one. So we can go, we could all go look at these environments and inhabit these environments, work our way through them, do things in them, same environments they're inhabiting. Because they've developed the skills, the athleticism, to engage with these environments in different ways, there's a sense in which these affordance spaces, as we might call them, literally show up differently for them than they do for us. Of course, just because we detect affordances in our environment doesn't mean that we always successfully actualize these affordances. Okay. I have been assured that both cats in both situations were okay, for those of you who are concerned. So as we negotiate everyday life, move through different environments of work, play, and rest, we move through different affordance spaces. So another technical term, it just means an environment of affordances, a landscape of affordances. These are richly structured environments, organized by a range of possibilities, action possibilities, that are provided both by features of our embodiment and the things and spaces around us. More formally, we can say that these affordances and the kind of affordance spaces that we inhabit are determined by evolutionary constraints, developmental constraints, and then normative or social cultural constraints. So for example, the fact that I have opposable thumbs means that I can engage with, manipulate, do things to my environment that organisms or creatures without opposable thumbs cannot. Developmental constraints refer to an individual's accumulated skill set, their life history, and so most of us can act on in the environment in ways that are more sophisticated in an embodied sense than young infants due to developmental constraints. Although clearly that's a pretty skilled young infant. Can't really see that. She's climbing a rock climbing wall. And then normative constraints refer to sort of styles of communication, patterns of interaction, respecting individuals' personal space. It could be that I go to a new country for the first time and I lack smooth mastery of the local social and cultural affordances. I've never been there. So I don't inhabit that landscape of affordances comfortably until I spend some time and adapt to these normative constraints. So I'm going to turn now to the second bit of terminology, jargon, scaffolding. So from affordances to cognitive scaffolding. Often, one of the ways we manipulate our affordance spaces is to scaffold our cognitive abilities. So this is a term from cognitive science, embodied and situated approaches to cognition. Cognitive scaffolding refers to various strategies or resources, things in our physical environment that augment and amplify our cognitive capacities. So for example, I might use two monitors to augment or scaffold my information processing capabilities while I'm working. Or just another screen to check Facebook and Twitter simultaneously. I might put little memory prompts, sticky notes on the side of my monitor to remember things for me so I don't have to carry this information with me in my head at all times. When I'm cooking a salad or making a salad, I don't spread all the vegetables haphazardly around my environment. I line them up neatly in the order that I need them. I see you're shaking your head, so that's a strange thing to do. Well, for what it's worth, I rarely actually make salads, so that's a confession. But if I were someone who made salads on a regular basis, I would do it in a very orderly fashion, manipulate that affordance space so I know exactly where the ingredients are when I need them. I use pen and paper to solve complex mathematical problems, or my smartphone, my computer. And I offload a lot of my information into my smartphone, addresses, contact information, all sorts of things. Again, I don't have to carry with me. These are all forms of cognitive scaffolding that augment and amplify our cognitive capacities. But we don't just manipulate our affordance spaces to manipulate our cognitive capacities. We also have emotions. We feel things. We are affective subjects. So we also perceive affordance spaces as affording opportunities to amplify, to suppress, to extend, enrich, and explore the temporal and phenomenological character of our emotions as well. So the things and spaces around us can be manipulated in ways that impact our emotions. So let's say I'm feeling depressed. I'm a bit down. What are my options? Well, I can seek out my group of friends, help me upregulate my negative affect. I can find a favored park and just wander around that space for a while, or a cafe. Maybe I'll drink some Belgian beer instead, or listen to my favorite music. These are all strategies for using scaffolding, different kinds of scaffolding, to actively manipulate our emotional and affective states. There's a third notion that can be useful here. So here's another video. And what I want to bring out with this video is the extent to which this scaffolding often becomes incorporated into our strategies or our practices of manipulating our emotions and affect. So watch this video. This is a short clip of Dan Mancina. He's a blind skateboarder. So watch what he's doing. He has this, obviously, stick he's using to probe and explore the environment. He's putting a timer there, a beeping timer, like my timer that was inexplicably going off a few minutes ago. There's actually a timer there beeping to give him an auditory sense of where he is in relation to that object. So here he is, kind of coming up on this wooden block, again, using the cane to explore the space around him to begin to plan his move. Close, almost pulled it off. I have to finish the video so you can see. He actually does complete it. There he goes. It's a pretty extraordinary thing he's doing there. He's very skillfully engaging with his environment. So why is this? What's happening here? Well, from a phenomenological perspective, and Merleau-Ponty has a great deal to say about this, this is an example of incorporation. So this is the third technical concept. I talked about affordances, scaffolding, and now incorporation. Incorporation refers, according to Merleau-Ponty, to processes where our lived body, so the feeling of being an embodied subject, takes something else into itself. Our embodied subjectivity is plastic, it's fluid, adaptable. It can expand and contract, according to Merleau-Ponty. And the cane example, which is one of his favorite examples, is a case where the boundaries of the lived body, or what he calls the body schema, expand to incorporate this material scaffolding into itself. The reason that Dan is able to navigate his environment so successfully is because he's no longer experiencing that cane as an object, as something separate from him. It's quite literally part of his lived, embodied subjectivity, his embodied agency. And this is an interesting phenomenon, Merleau-Ponty says, because it's a transformative process. It changes not only how we experience our embodied agency, but how the world, how our affordance space shows up in relation to our embodied agency. So in Dan's case, incorporating this cane discloses new affordances. On one hand, he can do things in his environment that he couldn't do without the cane. He can navigate it, skillfully engage with it. He can jump over things in a way he couldn't. But it also discloses new skills and forms of effective self-regulation that wouldn't be there without this cane. So now Dan can approach this environment with a kind of confidence, an affective equilibrium that might not be there without this scaffolding incorporated into his body schema. I hope that's clear, not too jargony. So one more kind of main point I want to make about this, and then I'm going to talk a bit about depression and schizophrenia. So we can appeal to these interesting cases like blind skateboarders or some of the other cases that Merleau-Ponty talks about, like a woman wearing a hat with a large feather. She instinctively ducks as she walks through a door. She feels that feather as an extension of herself. But these practices, these scaffolding practices, are common. We do them throughout our everyday life in different contexts, work, play, rest. In other words, we routinely construct self-styled environments that are configured specifically to set up, drive, and regulate in an ongoing way our affective and emotional experiences at multiple timescales. In other words, we incorporate this scaffolding. I have some examples in a moment if it's getting a bit too abstract again. We incorporate this scaffolding into what I would want to call our distributed self-regulatory system. There's a sense in which we allow features of the environment to do some of the emotional work and the effective work for us. We offload, to use language from cognitive science, we offload that work onto scaffolding in our environment. And that scaffolding elicits and regulates site-specific experiences, affective experiences. So consider, for example, the way that we decorate office spaces, the colors that we choose, choosing plants to put in them, configuring the furniture in certain spaces, the music that we play, lighting candles, incense, putting art on the walls. These are all practices of scaffolding designed to elicit and regulate our affective and emotional experiences when we navigate that affordance space. Churches are another example of these scaffolding practices. Consider this cafe in Tokyo. It's the material scaffolding in this cafe is designed specifically to elicit a kind of calm, zen-like tranquility, peace of mind. Contrast that with this cafe in Stockholm. It's obviously designed to elicit and regulate a different set of affective experiences. Or this restaurant set in a cave in Kenya. Here's the point of all this. Much of the work, I want to suggest, of regulating affect in everyday life occurs beyond our heads. It's not something that we do inside of us. It's driven and organized by rich networks of scaffolding around us, making up the material structure of our environment, the affordance spaces that we move through from one moment to the next. And now this is the transition point into talking about depression and schizophrenia. This is the key bit. So most of the time we take this scaffolding for granted. It's there, we've set it up to work the way that we expect it to, and it just works. When I walk into my office, I know that it's going to be there, regulating my affect the way that I want it to. If I have to share someone else's office for a couple of days, if they're doing some work in my office, let's say, that's a different set of affective scaffolding. And the sort of the disorientation I feel, the lack of affective stability, I think speaks to the extent to which this background scaffolding is doing its work most of the time without us thinking about it. So, in other words, the reliability and predictability of this scaffolding generates an implicit trust, a kind of feeling of at-homeness in our environment. And Matthew has done a lot of work unpacking this idea of feeling at home, trusting in one's environment, in his recent book, which he didn't plug, on depression. So I'll plug it for him. I guess not 2015, so a couple of years now old. But this effective trust appears to be what's missing or disturbed in schizophrenia. And so that's what I now want to explore, the connection between this loss of affective trust and scaffolding. I think that's an underexplored area of research in phenomenological psychopathology. So that takes us to part two, disturbances. So there's Wittgenstein. And he has this interesting quote in the Tractatus. He says that the world of those who are happy is different from the world of those who are not. I want to suggest, and given sort of the conceptual background that I've now set up, there's a sense in which this is quite literally true. I want to defend this idea. There's a sense in which individuals who are happy inhabit different affordance spaces than those who are not. But to put this another way, the main idea I want to explore now is, the main claim is that the affective worlds of individuals with severe depression and schizophrenia are different insofar as they inhabit different affordance spaces. Before I do that, let me be very clear. So, first off, I want to acknowledge there are some very important phenomenological differences between the sort of experiences I'll be describing in a moment in schizophrenia and depression. I don't want to conflate them or run them together. I think as phenomenologists, we need to be very sensitive and attuned to these differences and preserve them. And I'm also not, of course, suggesting that severe depression and schizophrenia have the same etiology or respond to identical forms of treatment. So I want to be clear about that. But the affective disorders in both, I want to suggest, often stem from a similar disturbance. Namely, the individual's ability to relate to and skillfully incorporate, in the sense that I was just talking about it, or fail to incorporate, affective scaffolding. The kind of affective scaffolding that the rest of us take for granted, actively structuring and organizing our background. Okay. So here we can turn to some reports, some first-person reports as phenomenological psychopathologists. This is what we do. We go to the experience. So these reports often suggest the feeling as though one inhabits literally a different world than other people do. So one individual with depression says, it is the glass wall that separates us from life, from ourselves, that is so truly frightening in depression. It is like living in a parallel universe. An individual with schizophrenia says, there's a pane of glass between me and mankind. Another individual says, I feel disconnected. A wall of void isolated me from everybody. It's as if there were two worlds. We can find many similar quotes in the literature. And one thing we can say here is that this feeling of being disconnected from others in the world more generally appears to stem from a diminished ability to flexibly adapt to the changing dynamics of a shared world. What does that mean? Well, one example is, I think this feeling of just being out of sync somehow with the world and other people is underwritten by a subtle but pervasive sense that one is consistently out of sync at a bodily level, so they're somehow bodily misaligned with other people. And there's a fair bit of interesting evidence that appears to support this, that people with both schizophrenia and depression find that their movements, their gestures, their emotional expressions, their patterns of speech, these embodied expressive components, are not spontaneously synchronized with or regulated by those of other people. So Thomas Fuchs, I think Matthew had mentioned Thomas a bit earlier, has this nice expression to capture this phenomenon. He talks about disturbances of interbodily resonance. There's a sense in which the body of the schizophrenic or depressed individual lacks a kind of resonance with those of other people that they come into contact with. So that's really interesting. That's also relatively well studied in the phenomenological literature, which is not to say that's not important, worthy of further analysis, but what I want to look at is a sense in which this disturbed bodily resonance also characterizes how individuals relate to the things and spaces of their material culture. So let me start with schizophrenia. So here's some quotes, and I think Matthew put a couple of these up here already. So consider the following quotes. These are quotes that characterize the sort of loss or diminished bodily resonance with material culture. One individual says, "Objects are stage trappings placed here and there, geometric cubes without meaning." This is a quote that Matthew had up a little bit ago. "When, for example, I looked at a chair or a jug, I thought not of their use or function, a jug not as something to hold water and milk, a chair not as something to sit in, but as having lost their names, their functions, their meanings. So the affordances of these things are no longer immediately apparent to the individual. They no longer invite the kind of smooth interaction that they do for most of us." And then another individual says, make this very explicit, "More and more, despite my effort, I lost the feeling of practical things, sort of the sort of affective contact or connection with the things and spaces around them." So Louis Saas, the psychiatrist, who's done a lot of work with Joseph Parnas, who was mentioned in the previous, in Matthew's talk, Saas calls this phenomenon unworlding. So he appeals to Heidegger and Heideggerian language. And so it's not, unlike most Heideggerian jargon, this isn't too bad. He describes unworlding as an experience in which things and spaces are no longer ready to hand. That's Heidegger talk. All that simply means is the stuff around us no longer shows up as inviting affordances. This remote loses its practical salience. Instead of being something I just immediately reach for and know how to use, I'm puzzled by it. It shows up with a different kind of salience. I've lost my practical access to it. The same with other objects and things and spaces in our environment. So the world is no longer shows up as ready to hand within this unworlding experience. More precisely, we can distinguish at least two phenomenological dimensions of this unworlding experience in schizophrenia, according to Saas. On one hand, individuals report a disturbed sense of reality as a whole, just sort of a loss of vital contact, as Minkowski puts it, a sense that one has lost kind of affective grip on the environment as a whole. And then secondly, and relatedly, a subtle but pervasive change in perceived action possibilities or affordances. This feeling, again, that one is no longer at home in the environment the way that one normally would expect to be, that the environment doesn't feel that it fits quite right. The individual feels out of sync. But we find this in depression as well. And I don't think this has always been appreciated by a lot of people working in this area. I'll exclude Matthew from this, since he talks about this phenomenon at some length, even though I have a slightly different way I want to push this discussion in. So we find similar discussions, similar characterizations in depression. So here are a few representative quotes. One individual says, there's the feeling that your life contracts. In a sense, one's affordance space just constricts and becomes diminished. You stop seeing it, the world, the environment, as an expansive project, and it all zeroes in on feelings of despair. Another individual says, you look at the world, the array of things that you could do, and they're completely meaningless to you. So they've lost this pull, this salience that they normally should have. They are as meaningless to you as if you were an earthworm, which is pretty striking. Obviously, if you're an earthworm, you inhabit a different affordance space. So an implicit, I think, reference to a kind of loss of affordance space or diminished, reconfigured affordance space. Another says, I feel very disconnected to the world, as if I'm floating, not quite there, visible to others. So what's the interpretation here? Well, what I want to suggest, given the conceptual background that I provided in the first section, where I'm going with all of this, what I want to suggest, I'm sorry, there's a bit too much text on the slide, I know, but I couldn't find a more concise way to say it. So the affective character of unworldly, the way it feels affectively, may stem, I propose, from an inability to reliably access and exploit the regulative resources afforded by different forms of affective scaffolding. So part of the character of this experience stems from losing access to this rich network of scaffolding and the regulative resources it provides that most of us take for granted on a moment-to-moment basis. When we lose access to that scaffolding, that reliable access, that leads to a diminished feeling of embodied agency. So it impacts how we experience ourselves as embodied agents. But it also, I think, shapes or informs, diminishes the feeling of being rooted in a socio-material environment. So this is a cause of this loss of at-homeness. And I'm saying socio-material here because even though I'm focusing on the material environments are always socially constituted. So the stuff around us is the kind of stuff that it is because other people have made it, share it, have defined it as such. So material environments are always social. I'm going to be very clear about that. But even though I'm talking just about the material environment, they're socio-material environments. Crucially, and maybe this is the most interesting thing from a philosophical perspective, without access to this scaffolding, without reliable access to this scaffolding, the individual, the depressed and schizophrenic individual, loses reliable access to the functional and experiential benefits that normally come from smooth, skillful engagement with the scaffolding. They struggle to regulate their experiences and their emotions because they don't have the help of the scaffolding around them, the way the rest of us normally do. That's the basic idea here. I hope that's clear. Okay. So let me motivate that a little bit by first pointing out some body schematic disturbances in schizophrenia and depression. So remember, the body schema for Merleau-Ponty is just a sort of tacit sense of being an embodied subject we have from one moment to the next. We know where our limbs are in space. We know that we can do things. We can exert our agency. We feel experiences from our first-person embodied perspective. We have this inchoate sense of I, me, mindness. No, I won't go there. I'm kidding. I don't like that language either, for what it's worth. So I much would rather talk about the body and scaffolding. And I get a little uncomfortable with precisely the same minimal self-talk that Matthew was criticizing. Okay, so I'm starting with body schematic disturbances in schizophrenia and depression. So it's well-replicated, there's well-replicated evidence of both diminished affective experience and expression. So people with depression and schizophrenia, as many of you know, show deficiencies or diminished ability to both feel affective experiences, there's sort of a diminished phenomenology to their emotional life generally, flat affect, and then diminished embodied expression, whether gestures, facial expressions, these sorts of things. This is more than just a neurophysiological deficit. We can't just account for this, phenomenologists would say, by just talking about neurophysiology. One of the reasons for this expressive deficit is likely the experiential distance, maybe the alienation, if you like, although there's some problems with that term, that many people with schizophrenia and depression feel from their body. So instead of alienation, I guess I would rather talk about a loss of bodily self-intimacy. So there's a felt loss of connection or rootedness or integration with. Now, I'm veering kind of close to this minimal self slippery talk, I know, by talking this way, but a kind of a loss of connection or intimacy with one's body. So we find first-person accounts that seem to capture this experience in schizophrenia. These are, again, pretty widely known in the literature and much discussed. So we find people saying things like the following. It's like I'm not in my body, I'm not attached to it. It's like my body is an appendix that hangs below me. Another person says, the body feels awkward, as if it does not really fit. Feels like the body is not really me, as if it is rather a machine controlled by my brain. Another individual says, I walk like a machine. When I am walking, I look at my legs, which are moving forward. I fear to fall by not moving them correctly. But we can also find some similar accounts in depression. And again, I don't think this is something that's always as appreciated to the extent that it should be. So although its body schematic disturbances in depression are not at the moment recognized by current classification diagnostic systems, they're there. And from a phenomenological perspective, they're arguably a core feature of the depressive experience. So often people with depression will describe their experience in vivid bodily terms. So they'll talk about being tired, heavy, lethargic, exhausted, sluggish, lacking a kind of embodied vitality. That's all interesting. But there's also just descriptions that take on a more articulated character that brings them much closer to some of the body schematic disturbances that we find in schizophrenia. So this is where things get phenomenologically a bit more interesting. They'll talk about, for example, experiencing their body in a kind of hyper-objectified or quasi-mechanical sense, the same way that people with schizophrenia often will. What does that mean? Well, here's a representative quote. And again, we find very similar descriptions in the schizophrenia literature. So this person with depression says, describes walking through a parking lot. This is how he's describing the experience. My legs snapped out stiffly, one by one, in sidelong kicks. My arms traced long, stiff arcs through the sky. My elbows dropped woodenly into my ribs. I must have resembled some short-circuited windshield wiper or some marionette gone awry. It's a good image. But who, where was the puppeteer? Who was in control of this body? And again, this is from depression. It sounds very much like the sort of hyper-objectified or quasi-mechanical experiences of embodiment that we find in schizophrenia. Now, as soon as you make those sorts of claims, this is where you have to pause for some phenomenological clarification. So I'm going to do that, just to be very clear. There is a difference that needs to be preserved here. I'm not suggesting that these body schematic disturbances in both depression and schizophrenia are phenomenologically identical. An important difference is the following. So very often the descriptions we find in schizophrenia are descriptions where the individual feels somehow detached or somehow alienated from their embodiment. They're sort of losing immediate contact with it. Whereas in depression, and Thomas Fuchs has done a lot of good work on this, the individual feels somehow over-identified with their embodiment. So both of these are kind of a loss of intimacy, either losing a kind of affective contact on one hand or becoming over-identified, sort of excessively rooted in one's body. Both are forms of kind of diminished bodily self-intimacy, but they are phenomenologically different. Thomas Fuchs labels this depressive experience corporealization, that in a sense one becomes too embodied, sort of rooted in or stuck in one's body. But this is the important point. So even though we can acknowledge these phenomenological distinctions, these body schematic disturbances in depression and schizophrenia are not just self-directed affairs. As Matthew was saying, the world is part of this story. And whereas he's talking more about the social world, in my case, I'm interested in the extent to which the experience of the material world somehow shapes this experience. So these disturbances, in other words, are Janus-faced, we might say. There's a self-directed aspect. They change how the individual experiences their embodiment and agency. But simultaneously, as part of the intentional structure, as Matthew might say, of this experience, they also change how the world shows up in relation to this disturbed agency. In other words, they reconfigure the individual's affordance space. So I want to be clear about that. Let's turn this way. It shows you the dual structure a bit better. There's both aspects are part of this experience. That's the claim. So they alter both the individual's embodied agency and their perception of their affordance space. Okay, so let me come back to schizophrenia and unworlding. So there's extensive evidence that schizophrenia involves a fragmentation of space and object perception. So individuals often report various perceptual anomalies. Again, Matthew, I think, touched on this a little bit. So they will talk about figure-ground confusion. So the gestalt structure of perception somehow begins to break down, and things that should be in the background move to the foreground and vice versa. It becomes difficult to differentiate the foreground-background structure. Other individuals talk about visual echoes, so visually perceiving a car driving by and seeing somehow tracers or after images of that car that linger in visual space. a bit like, I suppose, one does LSD or some sort of drug, tracer experiences. I imagine it's like anyways. Loss of perceptual stability, where things sort of lose their perspectival nature, their three-dimensional ability, where there's kind of a geometrical shift and things lose their density or their geometrical structure. All sorts of really puzzling perceptual anomalies, in other words. And unpacking these is part of the phenomenological task of understanding the unworlding experience in schizophrenia. But for my purposes, and to connect this to what I'm saying today, this situated perspective on unworlding that I'm advocating suggests that what's happening here is not just a perceptual disruptions of objects' practical significance, although of course it's there, that happens. They lose practical contact with the environment. There's also a loss of things' affective or regulatory significance. So things and spaces, in virtue of both body schematic disorders and this perceptual fragmentation, within schizophrenia no longer afford the kind of smooth, easy, skillful, self-regulative possibilities that the rest of us take for granted. They no longer function as reliable affective scaffolding that the individual can trust to elicit and regulate predictable responses. They no longer comfortably inhabit that affordance space and the affective scaffolding that's part of it, in other words. So again, what I'm suggesting is this is the body schematic disturbance as well as this disturbance of perception, perceptual anomalies that lead to this disturbed relationship with the material environment, with affective scaffolding. That's in schizophrenia. So the point of this is that this loss of at-homeness that is the core feature of unworlding in schizophrenia is tied to this loss of access to material scaffolding, or affective scaffolding, as I've been calling it. What about depression? This is the final big point that I'm going to make, and then I have my one slide of thoughts, concluding thoughts, and I'm done. What about depression? Well, again, there's something a little bit different phenomenologically happening here, and this is where we need to be careful in terms of of being faithful to the first-person accounts. So we do find similar descriptions in depression of unworlding experiences, but as I said, there's a different phenomenological character. So first off, people with depression don't seem to experience the sort of extreme perceptual fragmentation that people with schizophrenia sometimes do. So you don't find the same kind of perceptual anomalies. There are some, but not things like visual echoes or this sort of disturbance of gestalt structure, or these more fundamental structural anomalies that we find in schizophrenia. So it's important to note that. But the body schematic disturbances within depression that we were just talking about a few minutes ago do change the individual's affordance space. So they do change or reconfigure what stands out as salient and how it stands out as salient. So for example, severely depressed individuals will see things like bridges, tall buildings, train tracks and busy streets, packets of medication, knives and other utensils, guns, ropes, or other items. These things made instruments, tools, technologies that they can use to end their life, so things and spaces that can help them end their life, suddenly stand out as salient, as prominent. They come to the foreground of experience, whereas other things recede to the background. So that's a subtle change in their affordance space. There's even a more significant and phenomenologically interesting change that seems to occur. It's not just the salience of things that sometimes change, where suddenly an instrument to end one's life becomes more salient, and something that won't help with that project fades to the background. Even the basic meaning of everyday affordances can change when one is in the grip of feeling suicidal, for example. Not just having ideas about or thoughts about suicide, but being haunted by a persistent feeling, a desire to end one's life. So Benson and colleagues have done some really interesting work cataloging descriptions of this experience, where not just the salience, but even the basic meaning of everyday affordances can change. So for example, a window that normally offers a view that would comfort and bring peace of mind as you stand staring out of it, becomes a means to a quick death. So the salience, the meaning of that has changed. A knife that one purchased years ago in Tokyo at a market and normally prompts nostalgic memories and feelings of traveling with one's partner to Tokyo and buying the knife, he suddenly cries out as an instrument that needs to cut human flesh or can be used to use human flesh. Music that normally would bring one comfort and help regulate one's mood to a desired end state, becomes an instrument instead that haunts one, triggers other memories or associations, that affirms one's suicidal feeling. And the point here, once again, is that just the basic meaning of how affordances are experienced is changes. It's not just what one experiences, it's the meaning of the affordance that changes. That's a pretty profound reconfiguration of the depressed individual's affordance space. That's the idea. So here's the takeaway point, and then my one slide of final thoughts, and I'm done. So what I'm suggesting here, with all this conceptual background, all this talk about affordances and scaffolding and incorporation, what I'm suggesting is that individuals with severe depression and schizophrenia often inhabit different affordance spaces. They experience a kind of diminished bodily resonance, to use Thomas Fuchs's language, between themselves and their embodied agency and the things and spaces around them. So in that sense, Wittgenstein was right. And to bring scaffolding into this story, why I think a focus on the material environment is important here, this is an example of the way in which the environment is no longer experienced as a reliable or trustworthy source of mood-elevating affective scaffolding. The fundamental relationship to the way they relate to and experience the material environment and its regulative possibilities has changed. Rather, instead, I think this is especially apparent in the last example, the depressed example, instead of being a source of reliable, predictable, effective regulation, the environment instead becomes a source of agitation, continually nudging the individual, offering up cues or distraction with the change of salience and affordances, continually nudging the individual into patterns of affective disorganization, anxiety, or distress, I should say. Okay, so I promised one final slide of final thoughts. So what? Why does this matter? What's the point of all of this? Well, I think there is the general significance, maybe for those of us interested in phenomenological psychopathology, is the following. This is sort of the theoretical significance. To understand the regulative dynamics that are responsible for affective disturbances in conditions like depression and schizophrenia, we should adopt a more situated or holistic approach. So that's the big takeaway message. In other words, instead of focusing on things happening just inside the individual, kind of individualistic focus, we should instead focus on the way that affective function or dysfunction, as the case may be, is regulated by structures and feedback loops linking individuals with their affordance spaces. This is because the mechanisms of affective function and dysfunction are distributed across mind, brain, body, and world. So this situated or holistic approach is better equipped to capture this distributed character. And then here's the practical takeaway, and this is something that I'm not qualified to say much of interest about. I'm hoping some of you are. I think the practical takeaway is that if we accept something like this distributed approach to affective dysfunction, it suggests the need then to rethink our strategies for intervention and treatment. Instead of just focusing on the individual and endogenous strategies, we should tailor our intervention strategies accordingly. Maybe move away from just focusing, for example, on pharmacological interventions, neural interventions, and instead think critically and carefully about more embodied and situated approaches that help the individual reconnect and recalibrate their relationship not only with their body, but with the material spaces, the things and spaces around them. So, for example, perhaps strategies like more embodied strategies like dance, music-based therapy, movement therapy might be productive here. Things to help the individual connect more immediately with their body and the material scaffolding around them. And that's enough, I think. Thank you.